I just want to say, you're the first person that when we pitched our bosses at First Look that we wanted to talk to you, you're the first person they were ever like, let's think this through first. From First Look Media and Panoply, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm backup forward for the 1992 Dream Team, Hari Kondabolu.
They've been called the greatest team in Olympic history. Bird, Jordan, Barkley, and
Kondabolu.
The show where two comedians try to make sense of politics in America.
It's like if the Netflix show Stranger Things was a political podcast that had nothing to do with the Netflix show Stranger Things.
On today's show, we're talking with New York Daily News senior justice writer Sean King.
What the hell was that?
Oh, it's new. It's the controversy alarm. It goes off when we mention someone or something potentially too controversial for the show. Just keep going. I'm sure it's fine.
Okay. Sean King is currently writing a 25-part series in the Daily News on solutions to police brutality, which is 25 more parts than what the police have come up with.
You knew that was coming.
Ugh.
And in 2014, Sean, along with several others, used Twitter to emerge as one of the new voices of the civil rights movement and specifically Black Lives Matter.
Of course it went off. Black Lives Matter. Racist ass alarm. Oh, that motherfucker. Basically, if you're at all plugged into social justice issues, you've likely read or seen one of his stories in your newsfeed. Sean's writing is much read and is often the first voice you hear when innocent Americans are victims of police violence. His work makes him a polarizing figure, and he is no stranger to controversy.
Sean's had public beefs with other members of Black Lives Matter. He's been accused of disreputable fundraising practices. He's been accused of being a racist by right-wing publications like Breitbart and Glenn Beck's The Blaze. Wait, no alarm for The Blaze or Breitbart? Come on, alarm! And Sean became a national news story when many people accused him of pulling a Dolezal. People including my own CNN co-worker, Don Lemon.
Here's a breaking news tonight. A family member tells CNN that both King's parents are white.
That was breaking news? How slow is that news day? Has anyone heard of Syria?
And now Sean is in the middle of another national news story because he's friendly with America's favorite seated NFL quarterback, Colin Kaepernick. It's going to be a long show.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive.
Hey, Harry, what's going on, man?
Oh, man, I'm excited about this interview. It is a special one. I feel kind of ridiculous doing an introduction now because I feel like there's so much stuff that people need to hear. And we're just wasting time right now, and people need to get to it.
That's right. So today we're talking to the New York Daily News journalist, senior justice writer, Sean King, a controversial figure. He's going to go into it. We're going to talk about it. There is a lot of Colin Kaepernick talk. Just so you know, this was recorded in the afternoon of Thursday, September 1st, before the 49ers played the preseason game later that night. It's a great interview. And for the people who are familiar with Sean King, just so you know, it's impossible to cover all the things. He has had a lot of hits in the national news, and each one of those things could be an hour-long interview. So we go through some things pretty quickly, but yes, this is one where you definitely, if you're not familiar with this stuff, you're going to have a lot of research to do after this. And if you are familiar with it, you're going to be like, but why didn't you ask about we tried. There's no time.
And also, welcome to a lot of the new listeners who certainly are going to be listening to our podcast for the first time because Sean's on. And also, welcome to the trolls. We're definitely going to get after the show.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the trolls. All right, let's get Sean in here. Hey, how you doing?
Good, man. Hey, man, I was looking forward to hugging your neck. I didn't know you were going to be out on the West Coast.
My neck stays in Berkeley, mostly.
yeah, I get it, man.
So, first of all, welcome to the show, Sean.
Good to talk to you, man.
Yeah, it's funny. This is just how it works. I just thought I was going to pull up my Facebook, because there's a thing I posted on Facebook that I wanted to ask you about that we'll talk about later. And the first thing I see on Facebook is Sean King added 4 new photos.
You know,
Facebook knows that I'm reading you. So it's like, here's what you want. I'm like, thanks, Facebook.
Facebook knows a lot about us, man. They know like everything you buy online. They know what you like, what your favorite movies are.
They know we're here right now talking.
Apparently.
They probably do.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Since you're about to talk to him, here's the photos he just posted.
Thanks, Facebook.
I'm not convinced that Facebook's not a government front. I'm not quite convinced yet.
I mean, I think it'd be better if it was a government front. There'd be some rules. Like, I feel like it's the fact that it's not is what makes it really scary. But so we're going to get into a lot of stuff today. Obviously, you're connected to the Kaepernick story, Colin Kaepernick, which we talked about on the podcast before, and we'll get into that. And before we get started, I just want to give you a little bit of information about yourself, because you need to know things about yourself. So I just want to say, you're the first person that when we pitched our bosses at First Look that we wanted to talk to you, you're the first person they were ever like, let's think this through first.
You know, like,
and we've talked to like Amy Goodman, Dream Hampton. You know, we've talked to a lot of different people on this podcast thus far. But you're the first one. They're like, let's all talk this through. So, what do you think about that?
Well, it bothers me. You know, like I did this interview with BBC, and this was probably 6 months ago. I'm living in New York now, but I was living in Atlanta, and when they introduced me, I think of myself in one kind of way, right? And, you know, when I look in the mirror and see myself, or when I do the work that I do, I see myself in a certain way. When they introduced me, they were like, now we have Sean King, one of the most polarizing figures in America. Hmm. And I was like, whoa, like in my mind, I was like, it took me a moment to just kind of pause and say, wow, I cannot believe that this is how people see me. Or like, it's so even now when you tell me, you're like, hey, like we had to kind of pause and discuss and debate the merits of having you on, or the drawbacks. It still surprises me because, you know, for most of my adult life, I'll be 37 in a couple of weeks, and for most of my adult life, I've really operated in the mainstream. And while I've spoken out on issues throughout my life, I've really done so within the bounds of kind of what's acceptable in America. And so it's still surprising for me, like even over this past year, I've had colleges and universities cancel at the last minute. Mm. And these were places I had fully prepared to go to. I even had a university who had committed in a contract to paying me, and they still paid me not to come. And it's like, whoa, like I still don't fully know how I feel about being in this space. I mean, but every day I kind of live my truth. I try to speak out on the injustices that I see, and just let the chips fall where they may.
I mean, how does that feel to be that hyper scrutinized by everyone on the internet and on the news media? Because it's not like, you know, you aimed to be a public figure when this all started. It's not like, you know, you started already a public figure and you're getting more scrutiny. This has all happened in the last few years. I mean, what toll has that taken?
Well, you know, so I've always been a leader, and primarily I was always a local leader in Atlanta. And so I've been an activist. I've been kind of a speaker and a teacher. And so I've been known locally. But in 2014, I was actually working at an environmental charity called Global Green. Again, doing really kind of mainstream positive work. I was director of communications at Global Green, had a cushy office on the beach in Santa Monica in California. And on a random day in July of 2014, a buddy of mine sent me an email that really, in retrospect, I didn't know it at the time, but that email changed my entire life. He said, Sean, there's something so crazy on YouTube right now. He said, there's a video that I think happened a day or two ago, and there's a man, a grown man, being choked to death by the police in New York. And he's like, it's the craziest thing I've ever seen. And to show you how much things have changed over the past 2 years, at that point, I had never seen a video like that. I had protested the shooting death of Amadou Diallo, of Sean Bell. I protested about Trayvon Martin and other cases, but we didn't have videos of it. And sure enough, I clicked, and it was exactly as he described, and it really rocked my world. And at that moment, I thought, somebody's going to be held responsible. This is such an egregious thing that's taken place. And I became obsessed first. This was before Mike Brown, before John Crawford, before Tamir Rice. were killed by police all over our country, I became obsessed with Eric Garner's case and eventually left my job at Global Green to kind of focus full time on telling these stories.
Hold up, wait a minute.
Okay, let's pause for a second. Okay, so Sean has mentioned the names of a lot of victims of police violence in this interview. We're not going to go through all those names. Please look those stories up. Google them. All of their cases are heartbreaking in their own way. But one case we do want to highlight is the case of Amadou Diallo. Amadou Diallo was a 23-year-old black man, an immigrant from Guinea in West Africa. This is one of the first cases that I personally remember that became a national news story. And this was way back before Twitter, before Facebook, before social media, before the internet was really a thing. I know some of you are like, it was a thing. Not really. This was way back in 1999, and yet it still became a national news story. Amadou Diallo was killed in 1999 near his building by four plainclothes NYPD officers. He was completely unarmed and was shot at 41 times after an officer yelled gun, assuming that the wallet he had reached for was a weapon. Sound familiar? The officers were charged with second-degree murder, but all were acquitted. Sound familiar? One of the officers, Kenneth Boss, had also been involved in a 1997 fatal shooting of an unarmed man, yet he's the only one of the officers still in the NYPD. And last year, he was promoted to sergeant. So even though that was way back in 1999, not much has changed.
It only took me a few weeks, man, to realize, wow, a lot of people hate me for this. Mm. Like, it was probably just 2 weeks into just telling Eric Garner's story that I started receiving, for the first time in my life, hateful email, hateful tweets, like hateful Facebook posts. Like, I had people disagree with me forever, but like people, you know, like using racial slurs. And I mean, for the first time, I was like, oh, wow, this is weird. And then it was like, you know, every other day that would happen. And then it was every other hour. And then after a while, it was like every few minutes. And now here we are in 2016, kind of 2 years into the work that I'm doing. And the hate is very real and very constant.
And so you said you left your job, and you say you left your cushy job to sort of move into this work. And I just have a question as a parent. I know you have like you have five kids.
That's right.
Or seven kids.
No, five. You know, it's hard even people though, you come out. What's crazy is there are entire blogs and entire articles saying like, wow, the guy lies about having five kids. He really only has three kids, or he really only has four. Like every aspect and facet of my life is kind of debated. So my wife and I have three biological children and two kids that we've adopted. They're actually our nieces, but they've been with us since they were babies, and they are fully and completely ours, with full custody of them, and we love them. And
well, let me be clear, I wasn't questioning your right to have whatever number of kids you have.
right. Oh, I know.
I'm not going to come to your house and count them. I trust you.
And these are not people that are doing like incredible research to find out. They probably did a couple of Google searches and you know, if that much, and then put a story out there.
Well, it's like this, like they may find an article where I said I had three kids. Well, at the time we had three kids.
Yeah.
And they may find and they may find another article where we say we had four kids. Well, at the time we had four.
Yeah.
And so
that's generally how it goes.
Yeah, but that's the type of stuff that I'm up against. Like there was a doctor who, like a real MD, like I checked this out, who wrote an entire piece. I've had multiple spinal surgeries, and they all come from an assault when I was 15 years old. And I never had health problems before that, like none. I was, you know, just like any regular 15-year-old. And he said, you know, based on my diagnosis of videos where I've seen Sean walking and sitting, I don't believe he was assaulted, but I believe he had scoliosis. And that he has concocted this story of an assault and spinal surgeries, but I don't have scoliosis. You know, it's just like I don't have it. It's a crazy thing to see a doctor say, I've seen a few videos of him, and based on that, I think he actually has scoliosis. And it's like, so I've had to dig up people from my past to say, no, I was there when he was assaulted. No, I was there when he had the surgery. I, you know, I, and thankfully, you know, like any regular person, I've kind of lived my life around people who can come out and say, nah, I know this guy and this is actually his story. But that's kind of where we are. And it's wild, man.
It's also amazing that like one person or a couple of people can put this negative stuff about you. The number of people then who have to have your back, it's not a one-to-one ratio.
Right.
It's
right.
Like for every for the doctor to say that you need like 40 people to back you up, which is absurd. But because that person gets the attention, that person gets, you know, the certification, the stamp of like, this is the truth. And plus, I think people are looking... People want to believe the worst, especially at this point.
Yeah, like, and Kamau, I think I know even where you were going. I'm going to come back to that, man. But I think one of the things that bothers me, like, here's a prime example of that. So when I was assaulted in 1995, there was a police detective who came. I only met him one time. And we're talking, this was over 20 years ago. I mean, I was a high school student. And he was the detective in Versailles, Kentucky, who came. And he filled out a police report. And in the police report, again, this was pre-Obama, pre-kind of talking about what it means to be multiracial or biracial or whatever. Well, in the police report, there was a white box and a black box, and he checked white. And so that police report got out, and Breitbart and several media outlets said, listen, Sean filled out this form, and on the form he checked white. Well, one, I didn't fill out the form. It was a police report. But finally, the detective, Keith Broughton, who I actually have come to learn is actually a really good man. A lot of people in this small town love him and respect him. He did several interviews where he said, actually, even in 1995, I knew that Sean, first off, he said, I had no idea that 20 years later, people would be looking at this report. Mm. And he said, but secondly, he was there with his white mother and there was not a biracial or multiracial box. And he said in several interviews, I knew that Sean was biracial. And he said, quote, everybody in the town knew. He said, but I just quickly checked the box and there was no multiracial box like there is today. Well, conservative media never quoted that. They just went with copies of his report and said, look, we have all the evidence that we need. And at this point, when people run with it like that, the narrative gets away from you, and it's hard to kind of say, well, actually, the officer said this. When people already have their mind made up, it's a very difficult thing to combat.
First of all, I felt very awkward for you at the time when people were talking about what your race was, because it also came on the back of Rachel Dolezal.
So, oh, like, man, people yeah. Already... It had everything to do with it. It, you know, like, what people don't understand, Kamau, is, like, in the weeks before people started questioning my race, conservatives and like just bigots and these white supremacist websites, they were throwing 20 different things at the wall and nothing mm-hmm. was sticking. Like there was this thing that Sean has stolen from charities, which has never happened. There's not anybody on earth in anywhere who will ever say I've stolen a dime from them. It's a complete fiction.
Yeah, you've done a lot of work to really sort of lay out where all the money has gone.
Right, but
that doesn't seem to satisfy your critics necessarily.
Yeah, but before yeah. people, so people were saying that before they were saying the thing about my race, they were saying like, hey, this guy actually was not assaulted. This guy, he's lying about the number of kids he has. He's lying about, so they threw all of these things at the wall. And right at that same time, Rachel Dolezal came out. And we're talking about a woman who well into her adulthood, identified herself as a white woman, and actually sued Howard University for racial discrimination against her as a white woman, and then kind of strangely decided, which I don't think we've ever fully gotten the answer on when or how or where that happened, that she was going to pivot and begin pretending like she was a black woman. Hmm. And it was such a weird, juicy, peculiar story that caught on that all of a sudden, a story about me making this up about my own life started to stick. And I think had it not been for her, we probably would have never even gone there with me, but it came right on the heels of that. And to this day, I'm frustrated with with Rachel Dolezal. she obviously didn't do that knowing that it would make life difficult for a guy like me. But it made it easy for people to crack jokes and memes about who I am. Yeah. And my story is totally different.
they got to reboot some of those Rachel Dolezal jokes for you.
Right.
But before we get too far into this, there's also, because there is a part of this, that part of the narrative around you that also sort of comes through Black Lives Matter.
Sure.
And there's, you know, obviously the movement for Black Lives is important, has done a lot of good work. You have been identified as a leader in that movement. There's times I've seen other people who are identified as leaders in that movement sort of push back against you being called a leader in that movement. Some of that has happened online where there's been beefs between you and like DeRay or you and Netta. Like, how do you feel about, how do you define your role in the Black Lives Matter movement? And how would you talk about how you've had these sort of public beefs around that stuff?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, and I have several thoughts about it. You know, first off, the point that I try to make to illustrate for people, like, what is the Black Lives Matter movement? I get that even as I walk around New York all the time, I have like regular people say, Sean, can you explain to me what is the Black Lives Matter movement? Who are the leaders? And like what people are doing, literally, like they're going to the Wikipedia page and I am listed as a leader on the Wikipedia page. And they're saying like, okay, but can you explain it to me? And the best comparison that I can make is really the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement was people in cities all over the country, many who did not know each other, never knew each other, never worked together, of different generations, persuasions, education levels, backgrounds, preferences, experiences. But there became this moment in history in the 1950s and 60s where people all over the country said, we're going to have to take our fight against injustice to another level. Some of those people didn't get along. Some of those people saw the world very, very differently. And at that time, there was no organization called the Civil Rights Movement. What made this a little tricky is that the three women who originally coined the phrase Black Lives Matter.
And just to be clear, the founders of Black Lives Matter are three women of color, Opal Tometi, Patrice Cullors, and Alicia Garza. And you're all welcome on the show anytime. I'll bump anybody. I'll even bump Hari.
And all three of them are amazing leaders that I interact with and respect and love. They also said, listen, we feel led to do more than coin a phrase. We also want to make this into an organization. So unlike the civil rights movement, where there was not a CEO of the civil rights movement, there is the informal Black Lives Matter movement, which is just this ragtag collection of people all over the country who are standing against injustice. I am a part of that. Just like any leader that you know of from the 60s was a part of the civil rights movement if they were fighting against that injustice. But there's also this formal organization that these women have started and are leading, and it has chapters. And while I support that, I'm not a part of it. Now, like a lot of people, I think that call me one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, do so because I'm one of the most visible. Like I'm retweeted and shared on Facebook. And what's weird about that is 10 years ago, that would not have mattered. But in today's culture and economy, that means something. And so because people see me online or see me offline, they say, hey, this guy is a leader of the movement. I'm a journalist first and foremost, and that's the role that I have found myself in and the kind of the role that I've embraced. And the few times that I have tried to step outside of that role and do something more, be it building an organization or forming alliances, I've struggled outside of that role. And so a part of me has just said, listen, I'm having some success, not professional success, but I'm having some success shaping the narrative of what we talk about in America as a journalist, and I've embraced it. I think there have been a few times where I've disagreed with people in the movement online, but those are few and far between. Like, just like I said, you won't find anybody in the world who will say I ever stole a nickel from them. You won't find anybody in the world who will say they ever heard me say a crossword about anybody in this movement. And I've worked really hard privately and publicly not to do that. The problem is the few times that I have had disagreements, they weren't private. They were tweeting something. And so, you know, and so the few times that I've done that were really kind of boneheaded on my part of voicing frustration or criticism with people online when I should have either said nothing at all or taken it offline and done it that way. But a lot of us in this movement would not know each other if not for all of the injustice that we're fighting against. A lot of us are not natural friends and allies. We are, a lot of us come from very different walks of life. Some of us are religious, some of us aren't. And so some of us are as different as Dr. King and Malcolm X. And Dr. King and Malcolm X only met each other face to face one time, and that was almost accidental, and never really worked or supported one another. And so this movement is good and bad is a lot like the civil rights movement.
You said that you were a journalist, and you are like both in the space in the internet on the internet, but as well as in the daily news. You know, when mainstream media covers a story, it's from the politician's perspective,
sure.
It's from law enforcement's perspective, and then those who have been victimized, it's almost like they're on trial publicly immediately to prove their case. And what it seems like you're doing is, no, we're going to start the narrative from there. We're starting with the victims, and it's up to law enforcement, politicians, everyone else to be on the defensive. Why should they be on the offensive when the, you know, the victim has gone through all this already?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly what I try to do every single day. And what I also know is that every other press outlet, particularly local media outlets like the local television stations, ABC, CBS, and others, they're going to work really hard to tell the perspective of police and politicians. Even other mainstream outlets, be it the New York Times or the Washington Post, they're going to tell those angles. And so I see my responsibility, I see it as a calling to tell the story from the perspective of families and victims. Like this morning, I'm telling a story about a young man, Larnell Bruce, who was really lynched outside of Portland. And his mother wrote me a note this morning thanking me for the story and for pushing it out there. And, you know, I wrote a story recently where I referenced Amadou Diallo, and Amadou Diallo, who was killed all the way back in 1999. His mother is still daily grieving over this loss. He was a star in their family, and she never got justice. And she wrote me and called me and was just thankful that somebody still cared about her son to talk about him. And her worry was that this generation of activists and leaders would no longer know his name, and that he would just purely be a ghost in our society. And so I see my role in a lot of ways as making the stories of victims well known, and the pain that they experience, to make that pain known and felt and understandable. And so a lot of people say, like, hey, this guy is riling people up or angering people. I don't see it quite like that. I see it as I'm trying to tell the whole truth, and that whole truth, it should infuriate you. It should hurt you. It should bother you.
Do you think in our lifetime, and, you know, with health and everything, we'll probably live to be 110. do you think we'll see substantial changes with the police?
I think so. I believe that. And you know, my background is in history. Like, that's my academic training. And when I look over the history of America, there are great periods of injustice, which sometimes do last, not for decades, but for centuries. But we always see people fighting against that injustice, and that injustice changing and shape-shifting in very different ways. And so if we're talking about the abolition of slavery, if we're talking about a drastic reduction of lynching in America, if we're talking about the end of Jim Crow as we know it, where people all of a sudden have what is more like true voting rights in America, where in the 1930s, 95% of African Americans could not vote. And we think of, a lot of people think of America as changing right after the Civil War, but that's not quite how it happened. And people fought. And in the 1960s, we had the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. Now, those things did not alleviate all of our problems, by no means. But those are concrete examples, be it the 13th Amendment or the Emancipation Proclamation or the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act. Those are things we can point to and say there are times where America did change, where the United States did the hard work of changing. But it never happened on accident. And it always happened after a long period of fighting for the change that you want to see. And so, Kamau, right now, I think we're in the very early days of that fight. And I believe we'll see it in our lifetime. I think we'll even see it in the next 20 years or so. And that's my hope. And I hold on to that as an optimistic person. But some of it is because my gut is that we're going to continue to see some really horrendous ugliness with police brutality in America, and that if we think we've hit a breaking point now, I think we're going to push even past that, and that we'll finally reach some point where people will say, okay, what are the changes that we need to see? What do they look like on the local, state, and federal level? And I'm trying, and several people are trying to spell those things out now.
I mean, another thing I find so fascinating, Sean, is the media can accuse you of whatever they want to accuse you of, but I don't think they can deny that you do the work, because you do the work. I mean, there's a record of you doing the work, and whatever they want to say, you do the work. And just to step back a little bit, you were talking about speaking to the mother of Amadou Diallo and you know, her, how much respect she had for you, for the fact that you keep his memory alive and how important that particular story is. I think that's also important because this isn't a new thing. And people are treating it like it's a recent issue with police. It's not. This is generations and generations and generations of people sharing their stories and other people denying them.
You're right. Police brutality is not new. Social media allows us to tell the stories of it. But one thing that I try to correct with a lot of people is that it is actually getting worse, that injustice in America is getting worse. You know, in 1970, there were 200,000 people in prison. Now there are 2.2 million. That's worse. That last year was the worst year ever measured for the number of people killed by police in America. That the ugliest hate crime, the deadliest hate crime in the history of anybody listening to this, happened this year at the Pulse nightclub. It is at least the deadliest hate crime in the past 80 or 90 years. The deadliest hate crime against African-Americans took place last year in Charleston, in our lifetime. That not in the 50s or 60s or 70s did you ever have an incident where 9 people were killed like they were killed last year. And so I try to tell people, like, no, it feels like it's worse because it is worse. Mm. And but people come out
a lot. It feels hot. Yeah, that's because it's getting hotter.
Man, it feels that way in your heart and in your soul. And a lot of people are trying to talk us out of that and saying, no, it's because of Twitter or it's because of Facebook. And I accept that Twitter and Facebook allows us to tell more stories, but there are more stories. The things that I measure injustice in America by are getting worse. There are more hate groups in America. Mm. They have increased almost every year of President Obama's time in office. And so we're dealing with issues that are getting worse, and that pressure that it puts on people is very real.
So you talk about being optimistic. I sort of want to change it up a little bit. You read things about you online and get different sources. Were you the pastor of a mega church?
No, I don't.
You know, because I was like, wait a minute.
I mean, in the late 2000s, I was a staff pastor, like an assistant pastor at a large church in Atlanta. I was not the pastor of that church. And then I did start a church in inner city Atlanta that I led for about 4 years before we moved to California.
How would you have the time?
No, this is before this. He's had many lives, if you know, according to Wikipedia and Snopes and Breitbart.
It's just clear from all the things you've done and the fact that your name is in the discussion for so many different things, because you don't waste time. You're a part of it. And recently, you know, Colin Kaepernick sat during the national anthem for a few games, actually, was just noticed recently in protest of this country's treatment of black people and people of color at large. And it was such a powerful thing. And I know you have a relationship with him. It seems like there's a lot of trust there. What is the extent of your relationship with Colin Kaepernick, and how did you meet?
Well, I think first, before I knew Colin Kaepernick, I was a fan of his and a fan of the 49ers. And so liked him as an athlete, but I didn't know a lot about him personally. Mm. But I did know some of his kind of complicated racial story. And there was a part of me before any of this happened that kind of saw him as a guy whose complicated life made sense to me. Hmm. Of like, I'm also multiracial like he is. I also grew up in often like predominantly white environments and was, you know, working to see what does it mean to be a black man with a almost exclusively white family. And these are all the struggles that he had as well. And so from afar, I saw him and was like, yeah, I bet I understand him. And that was years ago. But I've read stories over the past, you know, week or so. He was evolving, Colin was, on issues of injustice over the past few years. It just hadn't gotten a lot of coverage. And he had done interviews before about how it was bothering him, but it wasn't as newsworthy, in part because it seems like every week in America, like, our house is on fire. There's a new tragedy, a new trauma, and stories like him as just a quarterback who's bothered by injustice didn't get a lot of pub.
Hold up. Wait a minute.
Okay, so let's take another pause because the Colin Kaepernick saga has continued since we recorded this episode. First up, Colin Kaepernick did not stand for the national anthem at the next 49er preseason football game. He actually took a knee because he had a conversation with a guy named Nate Boyer, who had played a little bit of preseason football with the Seahawks the year before, but was also a Green Beret. And so him and Nate had a conversation, and they decided a good compromise instead of sitting would be to take a knee, because that's a football thing, and I guess more respectful. I don't know how it works. But anyway, so Colin took a knee. And taking a knee with him was Eric Reed, another San Francisco 49er. And also a Seahawks player joined in, a guy named Jeremy Lane. He actually did sit on the sideline. And at his latest press conference, to answer the question, well, what's he going to do besides sitting? Colin Kaepernick announced this.
Yes, I am planning to take it a step further. I'm currently working with organizations to be involved and making sure that I'm actively in these communities. As well as donating the first $1 million I make this year to different organizations to help these communities and help these people.
And then in a completely different sport, Megan Rapinoe, who's a star soccer player. She plays professionally for the Seattle Reign. She's a gold medalist. She was also in the 2015 World Cup champion team. She took a knee before one of their games during the anthem in solidarity with Kaepernick. And not to be outdone, President Obama weighed in. He said that Kaepernick was exercising his constitutional right, though he acknowledged that it is a very sensitive issue when it comes to the flag and the anthem and what it represents. Basically, President Obama cut the baby right in half. His specialty. And also, let's not forget, there is actually like a football sports side to this issue. And so to cover that, I'm bringing in our one producer who actually cares a lot about the San Francisco 49ers, Max. What's up, Max?
Hey, come on. How's it going?
So what's the football side of this whole thing with Kaepernick?
Well, essentially, you know, he was this guy who rose to stardom really quickly, took the 49ers to the Super Bowl. He had a great year the year after, and then he kind of fell back down to earth really quickly. So there was already a lot of talk about his role with the team. Was he going to make it? So he didn't actually get cut, as was suspected might happen. But he is currently the second string quarterback for the 49ers.
So we can't actually say they made him the second-string quarterback because of racism.
I mean, I don't want to say that. It was kind of suspected that he probably wouldn't be the first guy to go.
I still want to blame racism. Just
say, okay.
Okay.
I think over that time, he and I started following each other on Twitter. And also, he and I have several mutual friends, both online and off, who know us individually, but we didn't really know each other. And
was it like sort of like, these two light-skinned black dudes need to meet? Was that sort of
No, not far from that, actually. Like I had a couple people who wrote me and it's like, hey, you know, this was before all of this went down. People saying, hey, you know, you guys really need to connect. I think you probably see the world in very similar ways. And so we just started exchanging. We wrote each other several times and kind of just greeting each other, encouraging each other. And then I started noticing that, you know, he was reading the articles that I was writing and sharing them, and he would write me and ask me kind of questions about them, what I thought about a story. He just asked me for more insight into them. And then I realized at that point that, like I was in 2014, when I first learned about Eric Garner's case, I saw something very familiar in what he was experiencing. I saw that he was, in his mind and in his heart, was going from a full-time football player who on the side was bothered by injustice, that he was struggling to figure out, like, wow, it looks like this injustice is the most important thing in the world right now.
Wow.
And how do I process that? And how do I deal with that? And so you can see in a really powerful way, you can see Colin's evolution, I think, best if you go to his Instagram. And you'll see where, you know, for a very long time, it was predominantly sports stories and just regular life stuff. And then you'll start
shoes, like rich athlete stuff.
Yeah. You'll just see kind of regular, you know, regular stuff. And then you'll start to see like, oh, he is deeply bothered by the shooting of Alton Sterling or the shooting of Philando Castile, that and he spoke out on those things on all of his platforms months ago in ways that were really strong for any mainstream athlete.
It was extraordinary, actually, going through his timeline, like after the fact, like, oh, this isn't new at all. He has a long history of caring about this.
Absolutely. I think that's what a lot of people did, because unless you are a 49ers fan or a Colin Kaepernick fan, you may not have followed him before this to know, like, oh, wow, he has been into these things. And I think what a lot of people don't know is, he graduated high school with a 4.0. Mm. He got scholarships. He was a three-sport star athlete. He got scholarship offers to places like Notre Dame and colleges all over the country for basketball and baseball. But he was determined to play football. But he really only got a few offers to play Division I college football, and that was his dream since he was a kid. I mean, as a kid, he literally said he wanted to play for the 49ers. Mm. And so he went, and it took his life on a path that probably causes a lot of people to underestimate him. And because I think America sees football players in a really one-dimensional way, they may not see this guy as like a brilliant intellectual. He's a very sharp guy who has really strong opinions. And back to his kind of complicated racial life, I think a lot of people don't understand how that shapes you in a lot of ways. Like, Kamau, people don't talk about, like, the oppression of light-skinned people, because it's not popular to talk about. And, like, I don't talk about it, and Colin will never talk about it. But what happens is, when you live the life that Colin Kaepernick lived, adopted by a very loving white family that he's close with and always has been, that is his family, he ends up living in very close proximity to a lot of racism and bigotry that the everyday African-American would not. Like, that they may have moments or issues. I'm not saying his adopted family were bigots, but I'm saying that he lived he lived day to day. Like, if he took this family photo when he was in high school, it was a striking photo because here he is, a young black man with white brothers and sisters, white parents. And I think people don't understand how that shaped Colin Kaepernick. They don't understand how growing up in Nebraska shaped Malcolm X, that he was the only black student in his school, not just in his class, where he said he was like a strange black mascot for the school. And it shaped his identity in a lot of really peculiar ways. And I think you find, if you look at a lot of like light-skinned black activists, even if it's like Jesse Williams or if it's myself or if you go back and look at Huey Newton or someone else, that some of that comes from this, we end up living a very different life that in some ways is more privileged, but also gives us a strange access to a lot of the bigotry. And I think that's Colin's story in a way, like even to the point that an NFL commentator, you know, said, you know, prominently, like, Colin Kaepernick is not black. And I thought right then and there, like, hey, I have lived this, of someone looking at this. And so a guy like Colin Kaepernick ends up having a real racial sensitivity in a way that's unique. A guy like Jesse Williams, who's the actor on Grey's Anatomy, but also an activist and an entrepreneur, or even myself, we end up having a real high racial IQ, where we end up often living in multiple worlds, back and forth between them. And I think that's, you know, that's a huge part of Colin's story. And I think he had gotten to a point where he was saying, what does matter? Hmm. What matters in my life? Is football everything? And I think the public, then got introduced into him with only knowing a small part of what was going on in his mind. And so when he decided to sit down for those first few games, he was actually injured. And a lot of people thought, like, was he sitting down for that? And I'm not even clear if was he actually sitting down in protest, or was he sitting down, what was on his mind? You know, like, I think he'll eventually talk about that and share that with us.
So you didn't know any of this was going to happen? Like,
he didn't talk to anybody about it. And I think had he told some people, they might have said, hey, don't do that. That's going to, out of love for him.
Yeah, they people who supported the cause would be like, no, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think, like, I don't know that I would have told him not to do it, but because I care about him as a man, I would have seen what the ways his life was about to change. There was a report, and it was a painful report that infuriated me, about NFL executives literally saying that they hate him. Like, that's a quote, like, I hate him. Others calling him a traitor. Another NFL executive said he was the most hated man in the NFL since Ray Carruth, who had the pregnant mother of his daughter killed, or of his son killed, rather. And it's like, really? You're going to put Colin Kaepernick on the level of Ray Carruth, a man who had a pregnant woman murdered? And so I think had Colin told anybody, people might have said, hey, don't do that. You know, it's going to get crazy. And so there's a part of me that's glad he didn't tell any of us, because we probably would have talked him out of it. And I think this is...
That makes it even more courageous.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's more courageous. And I think it's also, without being deep, I think this is all a part of his destiny, of his life. This is who... We will always look at him as the quarterback of the 49ers and this. Like, this is now a permanent part of his story. And I think he's okay with that. And I think he embraces that reality. And I'm thankful that he had a quality guaranteed contract that that allowed him to earn a good income before he did this, you know? And I think he knew that. At the same time, he did us a great service because he shined a light on some things that most of us didn't know. Like, most of us did not know how huge of a bigot Francis Scott Key, who wrote The Star-Spangled Banner, that was not a widely known fact.
No, it was not. That was not.
No,
Francis
Black
Scott Key
did
not
matter.
See this coming.
No, he did not. You know, as a matter of fact, what's wild about that is most people would say, like, back in the time of slavery, a lot of people saw Francis Scott Key as like enemy number one. I mean, literally, he was not just a songwriter. He was the district attorney for Washington, D.C.
Jesus.
And he fought against abolitionists. He even made giving abolitionist speeches illegal in D.C. His family owned plantations for multiple generations. He himself, as much as one, I hate to even use the word slave owner. These were human beings. He owned other human beings as property. And so, one, we have the fact that he was not just a man who owned human beings, but he was a terrible bigot. And even beyond that, we now have learned about this like third stanza of the Star-Spangled Banner, where he talks about and kind of celebrates the murder of slaves. And here's what's ugly about it, that the phrase "land of the free and home of the brave" in the third stanza was created to rhyme with slave and grave.
And now, the creepiest part of the Star-Spangled Banner, a song filled with creepy parts. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the Star-Spangled Banner in triumph dot wave. Getting my Marvin Gaye on at the NBA All-Star Game. Or the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Which conveniently rhymes with slave. Also, it horrifyingly rhymes with grave. American Idol, I should have auditioned.
And it's like, oh my God, my whole life we've had this phrase, land of the free and home of the brave, and this man created it to rhyme with his sentence about putting slaves in their grave. And all of a sudden, it's like, hey, even beyond what Colin Kaepernick is saying, maybe this just should not be our national anthem.
Sean, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. This is definitely the longest chat we've had with a guest, and by far. And
I feel like we didn't even get to like Bernie Sanders and Hillary. There's so much stuff. Yeah,
let's do it again.
But again, it was just an honor. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
Yeah, thank you, man. Glad to have you.
So, Hari, what did we learn today?
We learned that Sean King only really became publicly active on the Black Lives Matter movement in 2014 after seeing a video of the death of Eric Garner. What did you learn, Kamau?
I learned that Facebook knew that I was about to talk to Sean King.
Because it's a government front.
Yeah. I don't know that. I think that would make me feel better.
And I learned that Sean King's issues with Rachel Dolezal are much more personal than many of ours. And she made his life worse.
I learned that there's probably a position at the New York Daily News as junior justice reporter, in case I need to pick up another job.
I learned that Sean King really knows his shit. He is well-versed in the world, in history. He's somebody who is so clear and articulate and thoughtful and is so much more than 140 characters. And I learned that Colin Kaepernick is even doper than I thought.
I've learned that I would not want Sean King's job. That seems exhausting and depressing. I've learned that once somebody has more kids than I do, I just assume that the number is 7.
And I learned that the number of children you have can increase gradually over time. For example, you could start with 1 kid and then have 2 kids and then 3 kids and so forth.
Wait a minute. I'm going to write this down and see if this makes sense. So you can have one kid, and you have two.
Do the proof. Do the proof.
Wait, okay. Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Huh.
Well, that's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to all who have commented on Twitter using the hashtag politicallyreactive. We've gotten some good feedback and some good show ideas. We'll address some of your questions soon, so keep them coming.
And if you haven't done so, hit that subscribe button on whatever you're using to listen to this podcast right now. And maybe think about leaving us a nice little review. It's a very helpful way to spread the word for new shows like ours.
And if you're loving us, check out some of our other projects. I have a new album out now on Kill Rock Stars called Mainstream American Comic. You can get that everywhere. Also, I'll be touring and doing shows in San Francisco at Cobb's Comedy Club on September 22nd to the 24th. And I'll be in Houston on October 22nd and Dallas on October 23rd. You can find more information on HariKundabolu.com or more realistically on Google.
And I've got other projects going on, like my podcast, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. My live radio show and podcast come out right now. And I have a new album coming out, too. It's called Semi-Prominent Negro, and it's also from Kill Rock Stars. You can pre-order the album now. It comes out September 30th. Go to killrockstars.com to check it out. Also, I got some shows coming up. I'll be in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Portland. I'm doing a ton of college shows. Check out my sites for all the dates, wkamalbell.com.
Politically Reactive is a production of First Look Media and distributed by Panoply. The team includes Nick Borenstein, Lisa Langang, Erica Mu, and Max Jacobs. The show is engineered by Ted Muldoon.
Thanks again to Sean King for joining us today. You can find his writing at the New York Daily News. On Twitter, he's at Sean King.
Thanks to Panoply Studios in Brooklyn and Northgate Studios in Berkeley. And thanks to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show.
Ooh, that interview was intense. I think I need some chocolate to chase the sadness away. Wait, what? What's wrong with chocolate?
Well, chocolate's brown. That makes complete sense, because check this out. Oh, man, that interview was intense. I need some white chocolate. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Damn it.